10 p.m. New York time, the Columbia Workshop will present a summer festival of 8 of the outstanding dramas produced in this famous experimental theater of the air since its inauguration in July 1936. 5 new plays commissioned from some of the greatest writers of our time will round out the cycle of 13 programs. The revivals will include the following: A Half Pint Flask by DuBose Heywood, Never Come Monday by Eric Knight, A Trip to Zardis by Edwin Granbury, The Ghost of Benjamin Sweet by Pauline Gibson, A Drink of Water by Wilbur Daniel Steele, Meridian 71212 by Irving Reese, They Fly Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease by Norman Corwin, and The Fall of the City by Archibald MacLeish. Among those writers who have been commissioned to create original plays expressly for this festival are 3 who have never written for the medium before: William Theroyen, Lord Dunsany, and Dorothy Parker. We suggest that you watch the radio section of your local newspaper for further information on the forthcoming workshop festival. Now tonight, the Columbia Workshop presents Listen to a Story.
Want to listen to a story?
What kind of a story?
A short story.
What's the name of it?
Well, you can have your choice: Salesmanship by Mary Ellen Chase or Journalism in Tennessee by Mark Twain.
I'll have both.
Very well. The Columbia Workshop presents 2 short stories adapted for radio by Norman Corwin. The first is a little-known sketch by Mark Twain entitled Journalism in Tennessee, and tells about a young man who went to a doctor for the reason most people go to doctors. He wasn't feeling well.
How about smoking? Been smoking too much?
I don't smoke at all, Doctor.
Well, that rules that out. Frankly, I can't find anything organically wrong with you. What I think you need is a change of climate and some light work. Plenty of quiet, such as you can't get up here in the city.
I see. Any special part of the country you think I should head for?
Yes. Get down to a southern climate. You know anybody down south?
Oh, yes. I know a fellow who edits a newspaper in Johnson County, Tennessee.
You think he'll give you a job?
Quite possibly. Won't do any harm to ask.
Well, I recommend that you do that. You see, you're the kind of fellow who goes along all right, then suddenly you lower your resistance by catching a cold or something. In a climate like this...
I took the doctor's advice and wrote my friend, the editor. He responded very promptly and cordially, offering me the post of associate editor of the Morning Glory and Johnson County War Whoop. You can imagine how glad I was to be able to walk right into an associate editorship of a small-town paper in a climate which had been prescribed for my health. When I reported for duty... Good morning, sir.
Morning. Be with you in a minute. Sit down, meantime.
When I reported for duty, I found the editor sitting tilted back in a 3-legged chair with his feet on a pine table. He was smoking a cigar and trying to think of a word and scowling fearfully. I judged that he was concocting a particularly difficult editorial.
I'll tell you what you can be doing while I'm writing this.
Yes, sir?
Take the exchange papers on that table and skim through them. And if you find anything of interest, condense it into an article under the heading Spirit of the Tennessee Press.
Yes, sir. Well, I went through those papers and soon had enough items to put together into an article. I wrote it and it read like this. Item 1. The editors of the semi-weekly Earthquake evidently labor under a misapprehension with regard to the Ballyhack Railroad. It is not the object of the company to leave Buzzardsville off to one side. The gentlemen of the semi-weekly Earthquake will, of course, take pleasure in making the correction. Item 2. John W. Blossom, Esquire, the able editor of the Higginsville Thunderbolt and Battle Cry of Freedom, arrived in the city yesterday. He is stopping at the Van Buren House. Item 3. We observe that our contemporary of the Mud Springs Morning Howl has fallen into the error of supposing that the election of Van Werter is not an established fact, but he will have discovered his mistake before this reminder reaches him, no doubt. He was doubtless misled by incomplete election returns. Finished, I pass my manuscript over to the chief editor for acceptance, alteration, or destruction. He glanced at it, and his face clouded. He ran his eye down the pages, and his countenance grew portentous. It was easy to see that something was wrong. Presently, he sprang up and said,
Thunder and lightning! You suppose I'm going to speak of those cattle led away? You suppose my subscribers are going to stand such gruel as that? Where's my pen?
I never saw a pen scrape and scratch its way so viciously, or plow through another man's verbs and adjectives so relentlessly. But while he was in the midst of this work... What's that?
Oh, that's that scoundrel Smith of the Moral Volcano. He was due yesterday. Her son handed me that Navy revolver off the shelf there.
Oh, yes?
Thank you. This'll get him. Yeah, got him in the thigh. That'll hold him. And now, let me finish his editing job.
Well, did you ever...
What's his, son?
Oh, I just said fine weather.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, now, let me finish this.
Good Lord, what was that?
Somebody threw a hand grenade down that there stovepipe.
Oh, yes, and look, a fragment of the stove hit me and knocked out two of my front teeth. Look here.
Oh, now, that's a darn shame. That stove is utterly ruined.
Yes, yes, I believe it is.
Well, no matter. Don't want it this kind of weather. I know the man that did it. I'll get him. And now, look, son, here's the way this stuff ought to be written. Listen to this. Item one. The inveterate liars of the semi-weekly earthquake are evidently endeavoring to palm off upon a noble and chivalrous people another of their vile and brutal falsehoods with regard to that most glorious conception of the 19th century, the Ballyhack Railroad.
I see.
The idea that Buzzardville was to be left off at one side originated in their own fulsome brain, or rather, in the settlings which they regard as brains. They better swallow this lie if they want to save their abandoned reptile carcass, the cowhiding they so richly deserve.
Yes, sir.
That ass Blossom of the Higginsville Thunderbolt and Battle Cry of Freedom is down here again sponging at the Van Buren. That's item two.
Yes, sir.
Item three. Item three. We observe that the besotted blackguard of the Mud Spring Mourn and Howl is given out with his usual propensity for lying, but Van Werther is not elected. The heaven-born mission of journalism is to disseminate truth, to eradicate error, to educate, refine, and elevate the tone of public morals and manners, and make all men more gentle, more virtuous, more charitable, and in all ways better and holier and happier.
I understand.
And yet, this black-hearted scoundrel degrades his great office persistently to the dissemination of falsehood, calumny, vituperation, and vulgarity. Now that, my boy, that's the way to write. Peppery and to the point. Motion milk journalism gives me the fantods.
The what, sir?
The fantods. You see, it's all very well to write.
Caught me right in the back.
Oh, that was the colonel likely threw that brick through the window. I've been expecting him for 2 days. He'll be up now, right away. Oh, you see, there he is now.
It was the colonel, all right. He had a dragoon revolver in his hand.
Have I the honor of addressing the poltroon who edits this mangy sheet?
You have, sir. Be seated, sir. Oh, be careful of that chair. One of its legs is gone. I believe I have the honor of addressing that putrid liar, Colonel Blatherskott Tecumseh.
Right, sir. I have a little account to settle with you. If you are at leisure, we'll begin.
I have an article on the encouraging progress of moral and intellectual development in America to finish, but... There's no hurry. Begin.
Gentlemen, I don't like to interfere, but I've been shot in the arm.
Well, that's quite all right, sir. You're not in our way. Continue, you flea-bitten rodent.
With pleasure, you two-legged jackass.
More, gentlemen. Gentlemen, please. I am hesitant to keep interrupting, but I've just lost a finger in the last exchange. And since this is a private matter between you two, I have a delicacy about participating in it any further. If you don't mind, I shall go out and take a walk, and perhaps find a surgeon to administer to my wound.
Oh, no. Won't hear of it. You're no bother at all. You just sit there where you can watch me finish the corrupt and vile Colonel Tecumseh in the next exchange.
By all means, sir. I can but assure you that it is pleasant indeed to have you as an audience and a witness to my imminent triumph over a degenerate and insufferable hypocrite and crook. Let us reload and continue.
How's the weather been down your way, Colonel?
Oh, pretty dry for this time of the year. How's it been up this way?
Pretty good. A fine crop of tobacco this season.
Splendid. You all finished reloading?
Just a second now. There.
Let us commence where we left off.
No sooner said than done, sir.
I guess I have been mortally wounded.
Yes, appears you have.
Well, I'll have to say good morning to you now, as I have business uptown.
Just as you say, Colonel.
Which is the way to the undertaker's?
Oh, you'll find that 3 streets up and then to your left.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Now, son, I'm expecting company to dinner and shall have to get ready. It'll be a great favor to me if you will read proof and attend to the customers.
But, sir...
Jones will be here at 3. Cowhide him. Gillespie will call earlier, perhaps. Throw him out of the window. Ferguson will be along about 4. Kill him. That's all for today, I believe.
But, sir, if...
And if you have any odd time, you may write a blistering article on the police. Give the chief inspector rats.
Rats, sir?
The cowhides are under the table, weapons in the drawer, ammunition there in the corner. Lint and bandages up there in the pigeonhole.
I know, sir, but if...
In case of accident, go to Lancet, the surgeon downstairs. He advertises. We take it out and trade.
Yes, sir.
Goodbye now.
Listener, I can't begin to tell you about those next 3 hours while the chief was gone. I went through perils impossible to convey by the spoken word. Gillespie called and threw me out of the window. Ouch! Jones arrived, and when I got ready to do the cowhiding, he took the job off my hands. Ouch! A stranger by the name of Thompson left me a mere wreck and ruin of chaotic rags. Ouch! And at last, at bay in the corner, and beset by an infuriated mob of editors, blacklegs, politicians, and desperados who waved and swore and flourished their weapons about my head till the air shimmered with glancing flashes of steel, I was in the act of resigning my berth on the paper when the chief arrived, and with him a rabble of charming and enthusiastic friends.
Oh, trying to influence my associate editor, are you, you dirty vermin? We'll see about that.
Oh, is that so?
There ensued a scene of riot and carnage such as no human pen or steel one either could describe. People were shot. Oh. People, I say, were shot, drove, dismembered, thrown out of the windows. There was a brief tornado of murky blasphemy with a confused and frantic war dance glimmering through it. And then all was over. In 5 minutes, there was silence. And the gory chief and I sat alone and surveyed the sanguinary ruin that strewed the floor around us.
You'll like this place when you get used to it.
Sir, I'll have to ask you to excuse me. I think maybe I might write to suit you after a while. As soon as I had some practice and learned the language, I'm confident I could.
Why, of course, son.
But to speak the plain truth, that sort of energy or expression has its inconveniences, and a man is liable to interruption. You see that yourself. Vigorous writing is calculated to elevate the public, no doubt, but I can't write in comfort when I'm interrupted as much as I've been today.
Interrupted? Oh, you'd hardly call that interruption, son.
I say, I like this berth well enough, but I don't like to be left here to wait on the customers. The experiences are novel, I grant you, and entertaining, too, after a fashion, but they are not contributory to good health. Really, I never had such a spirited time in all my life as I've had today.
Why, son, don't you like it here?
No, sir. I like you. And your calm, unruffled way of explaining things to the customers. But you see, I'm not used to it.
The Southern heart is too impulsive. Southern hospitality is too lavish with a stranger.
Oh, thank you, son.
The paragraphs which I have written today, and into whose cold sentences your masterly hand has infused the fervent spirit of Tennessean journalism, will, I am sure, wake up another nest of hornets.
Hornets? Low-down, ornery fleas, that's what.
Yes, all that mob of editors will come, and they will come hungry, too, and want somebody for breakfast.
Well, now, don't pay any attention to them.
Sir, I shall have to bid you adieu. I decline to be present at these festivities. I came south for my health, and I will go back on the same errand, and suddenly, Tennessee journalism is too stirring for me.
Well, son, if your mind's made up, your mind's made up. Sorry to see you go. Good luck, son.
Thank you, sir. It's been extremely diverting and instructive. Good luck to you.
Goodbye, my boy, and take care of yourself. Good luck.
After which exchange of good wishes, we parted with mutual regret. And I inquired of the first man I met on the street. I beg your pardon, sir.
What can I do for you, stranger?
Tell me, which way to the hospital?
The second of tonight's adaptations is Mary Ellen Chase's famous short story, Salesmanship.
The man who just came down those steps is Henry Staples. He's feeling pretty chipper this morning, and that tune he's humming on his way to work could very well be a sort of theme song for all happy and confident men. Know why Henry is happy and confident? He's just finished a $15 course on salesmanship, and as a consequence, he is now excellently equipped for his career.
Morning, Clarence.
Morning, Henry.
That was Clarence McKenzie, Henry's next-door neighbor. Real nice fella, Clarence. Of course, you understand the full prophecy of Henry's new course in salesmanship has yet to be realized. The manager of the store has yet to call him in and say,
Henry, I want to shake your hand. You certainly got what it takes. And believe me, I'm mighty proud of the job you've been doing. No, don't try to deny it. Your salesmanship has been an example and an inspiration to the whole organization. I wonder, Henry, whether you'd object very much if we just doubled your salary.
No, the manager hasn't yet got around to that, but still there's already been an indication. Why, only last Saturday, Henry was advanced from boy's underwear and stockings to suits. Things are definitely on their way, no question about that. Even his wife, Nora, has noticed the change in him. For example now, notice the way Henry's benevolence diffuses itself among his fellow employees as he reports for work at 8:56 a.m.
Why, good morning, Edgar. How are you this morning?
Morning, Mr. Stable.
Edgar is a floor polisher.
Oh, Miss Piper, I hope you feel as fine as you look this bright morning.
Thank you, I'm feeling fine, Mrs. Staples.
Miss Piper is a stenographer.
A very good morning to you, Miss Nesbitt.
Morning, Henry.
That's Nesbitt, still in the underwear.
Greetings and salutations, Mr. Staples.
Hello.
That's Sims, been selling belts and suspenders for years. Well, Henry has reached his own counter now, and off go the white coverings.
Neat and tidy.
There. Done? The store will be open for business very soon now. And as a matter of fact, there are two people standing outside the main entrance right this moment, waiting for 9 o'clock. Henry has already marked them as his own. Henry's got them all psychoanalyzed in advance. Well, there go the doors open, and those two people are coming right over to Henry's counter. Yes, sir, they are.
Good morning. Isn't it a dandy day, huh? Well, I'm at your service.
I'm looking for a blue suit for a boy, 12 years of age.
Certainly. Our stock, may I say, is excellent. Were you thinking of serge or cheviot?
I hadn't thought very much of the material.
I see. It's color you want. But material is important. I'll take my word for that. No, there's a lot to be said for both. Serge may be dressier, but cheviot won't take a shine or show spots like serge. And it's newer. It's sure to be worn now by boys and men for two seasons straight.
I see.
Henry has turned toward the cases. He feels vaguely troubled. He likes interest in his customers. Makes things go better if they're fussy and hard to suit. He's groping about in his mind now for something to liven things up a bit. Here it is.
You said 12 years old? Now, that's an age to keep you guessing, isn't it? I have a boy 12 myself. They're alive to everything at 12.
Queer how some folks expect the salesman to do it all. Yet Henry has been forewarned by his course of just such an attitude. Well, the only thing for him to do is start on another and more direct attack.
How big a boy is he? Large for his age or small?
I think you'd say average.
It's always more satisfactory to bring them along, but of course there is school.
Yes.
Henry is spreading out four suits for her inspection and thinking how funny it is that her husband offers so little help. The husband is standing at the extreme end of the counter, fumbling with the buckles and straps of some knickers piled there. Henry is ready to pursue the sale now.
You wouldn't want me to lay these aside now and bring him in, say, at 4 to try them on?
No, I think not. I'll choose them myself.
I know just how it is. Try to catch a 12-year-old after school and there's something doing. It's funny how when they get older...
It looks about right to me, the Cheviot one.
Well, you can't go wrong on that, no matter what. That is genuine Scotch Cheviot, all wool to a thread. My word on it, madam, and the store's guarantee. That is the suit that'll wear the toughest youngster in this town a good 2 years.
The woman is fingering the cloth, and with a sudden gesture, she puts her hand in one of the pockets of the coat. Henry understands the reason for that, all right.
I see. Yes, a boy always does raise an head with pockets, but these are tough ones and lined with the best. He won't sag these no matter what he fills them with.
She's still keeping her hand in that pocket. Henry's beginning to feel foolish standing there holding the suit up on its hanger. Oh, say something, Henry.
It's good and roomy.
She has withdrawn her hand.
But there is one drawback. There's only one pair of pants to this suit. Most have knickers and longs, but this has only the longs. But most kids now wear longs. You see, in a sort of dressy suit like this, they don't
I believe I'll take this very suit. He's always wanted long trousers, but I thought them rather silly for small boys.
Oh, they're all the rage, madam. And once he wears them through, you can just combine the coat with sports knickers or flannels, and presto, he's fixed as good as new.
Henry was not prepared for this silence. The customer, he's thinking, might at least acquiesce in such an economical suggestion.
Well, he'll be surprised this noon when he comes home and finds his longs, eh?
We're in somewhat of a hurry. If you'll do the suit up, please.
Oh, certainly.
That was the husband. First peep heard out of him, and not too cordial either.
Well, we sure must trust each other. Here I entirely forgot to tell you the price or you to add.
It doesn't matter. How much?
Cash or charge.
I'll pay for it.
Now, let me see this price tag here. $29.50. I know, that seems a bit steep for a growing boy, but I'll guarantee your money's worth. And if he outgrows it quick, send him in. Alterations free. And here's my card.
Thank you. You've been very kind, I'm sure.
Oh, not at all. We aim to please. Oh, I'll tell you what, madam. With a sale like this, we like to throw in a bit of a gift. This spring, it's a baseball. A good big league number. None of you twine and sawdust balls. And if you'll just show your slip in the sports department and my card, they'll give you one. And present it to the young man with my compliments. And here you are, your suit all wrapped up and ready for you.
We're late, Margaret. Come on, darling.
Henry can't figure this out. When the husband said, "Come on, darling," just then, he pulled at her arm rather roughly. The word of endearment hardly went together with the tone and gesture. Strange people. But what about the baseball? Maybe the woman didn't hear his offer of the baseball. Well, if these queer customers don't want something for nothing, why, the store is but the gainer. Oh, hold on. Wait a minute, though. Henry has just recalled an omission which must be rectified. He's hurrying after them, book in hand.
I told you, Margaret. I told you. I told you it was crazy to do it yourself.
Don't worry, dear. I wanted to. And I'm pleased about the long trousers. He's always wanted them.
I beg your pardon. I wanted to catch you before you'd gone. Even with cash sales like this, the store asks for names and addresses so we can keep track of our patrons. I hope I may have the pleasure of fitting out that youngster again.
Well, can you imagine that? The husband looks downright resentful. Henry is coloring a little in this silence. But now the wife is smiling at him and Henry feels a little easier. Goes to show you the course book was right. Henry's temperament was made for dealing with women, all right.
Of course we'll give you our name. Mr. and Mrs. Charles Seymour, 100 Forest Avenue. And thank you again.
Not at all. Thank you, Mrs. Seymour. Goodbye, Mr. Seymour.
Well, that was Henry's first sale as a newly promoted member of the suit department. It was a good enough sale, but a queer one. One hard to dominate by his own personality. Still, all in all, a good sale. No getting away from that. The morning wore on. Henry went out to lunch. In the afternoon, he sold a tweed suit to a tall man, and a blue serge to a fat one. And, at closing time, he pulled the white coverings over the counter and went home.
Good night, Mr. Sam.
Take it easy.
Good night, Mr. Nesbitt.
Good night, Mr. Staples.
Good night to you, Miss Piper.
Good night, Mr. Staples. Don't take any wooden nickels.
Well, I'll try not to.
It is evening now, and Henry Staples is at home, stretched out luxuriously upon the green davenport with his paper under the bridge lamp. He had a good day and has earned his relaxation. In a moment, you'll hear some cuss words from his boy, Charlie, who's fussing with a radio set at the other end of the room. Can't seem to get it to work.
Oh, gee whiz. What the heck's the matter with this darn old radio anyway?
Henry is undisturbed. He's a thorough reader of his paper. He's already been through the sports section, even read the society column. Often finds names of his patrons there.
Hey, Dad, I wish you'd help me here. The dial light's up, but there isn't anything coming out of the speaker. Not even static. Oh, come on, Dad, will you? Oh, put down that paper and help me, will you, Henry?
Henry, what's the use of having a radio if it don't work? Why don't you help Charlie if he wants some help?
But Mr. Staples' eyes are concentrated on one spot of the paper, in the last column, on the next to the last page.
Seymour. On Sunday, Charles, age 12, only son of Mr. and Mrs. Charles Seymour, 100 Forest Avenue. Funeral Tuesday at 2 o'clock.
Dad, this thing's all mixed up. I can't do nothing with it.
Henry, are you suddenly gone deaf or something? Give me that paper. Why, you're reading even the death. Don't you hear, Charlie?
Yeah. I'll help you with the radio, Charlie.
Thanks, Dad. I don't know. I couldn't find no loose wires, Dad. See if you can find anything. What's that? Oh, maybe it's ground over it now.
Henry is thinking to himself now how queer it is that you can't tell some folks some things even after you've lived years with them.
You don't seem to be doing much better, Dad. Funny we can't seem to get anything on it.
Yeah, there, Charlie.
Henry is passing a hand across his forehead, a little bit dazed. He glances about the room now, seeing its tight security, the fat pink cushions, Nora in her beflowered rubber apron, Charlie in his blue suit, and his course book on salesmanship on the table awaiting his half hour of review study.
Ain't it funny, Dad, this thing should go wrong so all of a sudden?
Yeah, it is funny. Most things are kind of funny, I guess.
You have been listening to the Columbia Workshop presentation of Listen to a Story, arranged and directed for the workshop by Norman Corwin. The role of Henry the Salesman was played by Carl Swenson, with Louis Van Ruten as narrator. The Mark Twain story was narrated by Carl Frank, with Arnold Moss portraying the editor of the Morning Glory and Johnson County War Whoop, and Everett Sloan, Colonel Tecumseh. There will be no workshop next Monday due to a special broadcast announcing the annual radio awards of the National Federation of Press Women. May we again call your attention to the fact that the next workshop broadcast will be on Thursday, July 6th at 10 p.m. New York time. This will mark the opening of the Columbia Workshop Festival, the first broadcast of which will be a revival of a half-pint flask by DuBose Haywood and will be directed by Irving Reese from Hollywood, California. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.